Welcome to the Education Gadfly Show. I'm your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. Today, Jeanette Luna, a development and research associate at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, joins us to discuss the competitive pressures facing America's largest school districts. Then, on the Research Minute, Amber reports on a new study investigating whether grade inflation has begun to recede since a pandemic-era spike in GPAs. All this on the Education Gadfly Show.
This is the Education Gadfly Show.
The first thing I noticed about the study is that it took place in Washington, which is another school that is in the college football playoffs, but they are ranked below Michigan.
What does Gadfly say?
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at fordhaminstitute.org. And now, please welcome our special guest for this week, Jeanette Luna. Luna, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Mike. Happy to be here.
Luna is a development and research associate at the Fordham Institute. We call her Luna. Everybody calls her Luna. That is what we will do here on the show today. That's also what David Griffith will call her. David Griffith, my co-host, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Mike. Always a pleasure.
Yeah, well, listen, we are doing one of these special self-promotion episodes of the podcast because guess what? We've got a super cool new analysis out that was led by David and Luna. And we're going to talk all about that. It is about competition in the United States and in our school system and a new index that tries to rank large school districts on the degree to which they are experiencing education competition. Let's do that on Ed Reform Update. Okay, David and Luna, it is called the Education Competition Index, quantifying competitive pressure in America's 125 largest school districts. Congratulations. Luna, let's start with you. You know, we make the case that there's a lot of research showing that competition is a good thing, not just for the kids that get to participate in school choice, but also for the kids who remain in traditional public schools. Can you say more about that?
Yeah, so there's a strong moral argument for competition, right? Having the ability to change schools is inherently empowering for families, because if a school is not worried about losing students, they're more likely to take them for granted. So my mind immediately goes to low-income districts with mostly Black and Brown students. If there's just one traditional public school in that district, it's easier for the district to get complacent towards those kids. And it's not to say that traditional public school teachers aren't motivated and doing everything they can for students, but there's just so many institutional barriers to serving kids well in these low-income neighborhoods. And if you're not losing enrollment, you don't have as much incentive to do that. But if you're competing with the charter school down the street, then you're forced to kind of up your game. And that can look different in a lot of different schools. It's not just about test scores. You could be adding more after-school programs. You could be adding a VOAG program. You could be adding SEL components. And ultimately, the research shows that everybody wins, both the students who remain in those traditional public schools and then also the ones who go to their competitors.
Yeah, and very well said, Luna. I love it. And, you know, you spell out what was once just a hypothesis, right, that competition in education would work its magic like it does in other sectors of our world. But here we've got evidence now that it really does seem to make an impact. And it's interesting, certainly in the charter school world, but also in the private school choice world where, you know, the participant impacts have not been looking very good lately. You know, kids using voucher programs and some of the larger programs, those students, it looks like are in some cases losing ground, but their peers who are still in traditional public schools are benefiting. You know, it seems like any kind of choice and competition, at least that has been tested, is something that is good for the kids in traditional public schools. It puts some pressure, competitive pressure, on their schools to improve. All right. So, David, when you came up with this index, the point is to try to compare districts to the degree to which they face competition. You must have come up with an incredibly complex algorithm in order to do this. Yes.
Yeah. As usual, it's sort of shockingly simple when it comes down to it. Look, there's a lot of things that go into competition. It's kind of funny when you think about it, right? Because we all think we know what competition is, but actually observing schools competing, I mean, that's not something you actually observe, right? You don't, unless they're on a soccer field or at a track meet. Like, what do we actually mean? How do we know that they're competing? And the short version is, we don't really observe it, but we can infer it, right, when there are real alternatives there. So it's a very straightforward approach. All we really do is take the kids that we think are in truly independent institutions, right? Charter schools, private schools, homeschools, and we try to add those three categories up. And divide it by the total number of kids in a district, public and private. And believe it or not, this has never really been done before, in part because the data are kind of, frankly, questionable and problematic in some places. But we did our best. And I think it's a pretty interesting report. We've got this great visual towards the end where we show in each of the 125 biggest districts, basically how the level of competition, or if you prefer, school choice, has grown between 2010 and 2020. You know, how, what sectors are driving that growth, how growth has, you know, changed for some groups more than others. So, you know, I think the results are enlightening, despite the fact that this is something people think they already know.
And what's fascinating, you do mention the subgroups. You know, one of the big findings is that in most places, it's actually white students who are participating in school choice more than other students. And that is driven by private schools, right? I mean, you still have got these places, certainly some of the big suburban districts that are a part of this group, like where my kids go to school, Montgomery County, Maryland, where there is not much of any public school choice, charter schools, maybe not a ton of homeschooling, but there are private schools, but they're expensive. And so it tends to be the more affluent student groups partaking in those. And yet, Luna, you know, when you look at the changes from 2010 to 2020, what did we find?
A number of things. First of all, one thing we saw that is, in general, most districts aren't facing that much competition, right? Like you mentioned. So people talk about the fact that traditional public schools are dying out, but that's not really the case. In the median district, we found that 80% of students are still attending their local traditional public school. But that being said, most districts are seeing increases, largely due to charter schools, and that private schools are not contributing much, if anything, to the growth in competition over the last decade.
Yeah, I mean, we've got basically private school enrollment flat. Maybe some of the brand new education savings accounts programs may change that eventually, maybe. Although the way they're structured, they seem to mostly be subsidizing kids already in private schools. But the charter school movement, as Jed Wallace wrote in Education Next the other day, keeps on keeping on. You know, even in the 2010s, which some of us, okay, myself, have written as a lost decade for education reform, charter schools did keep growing. Maybe not as fast as in the past, but they did keep growing. And so now you've got these big districts where there is more competition, especially for non-white kids, right? It's especially Black and Hispanic kids that continue to choose public charter schools when and where they are available. And, you know, places, of course, New Orleans is a special case. There's basically no district left, but San Antonio and Washington, D.C., both up around 50% of kids in non-district alternatives. Other cities like Milwaukee and Detroit and Cleveland, pretty close. David, one of the reasons I was interested in doing this analysis, or having you and Luna do this analysis, was to find out if there were some places where there's still plenty of room for growth. And again, Luna just said there's a lot of places around the country where there's not a lot of school choice. But, you know, if we're talking about places that are mostly suburban, mostly affluent, maybe those aren't as easy to sell, you know, and maybe they don't have as great a need for school choice. But we found that there are some urbanized areas, plenty of population density, and plenty of poor kids and kids of color who have benefited the most from charter schools, especially where there is room for growth. Can you talk about some of those?
Yeah, I mean, I really encourage people to go to the report page and look for themselves, because a picture is worth a thousand words. But, you know, I was surprised. I mean, it's so important to separate the media narrative about school choice, right, from like the actual numbers. Right. So, I mean, a good example is Arizona, right? I think of Arizona, you know, I think of the like long list of, you know, private school choice programs, public, you know, charter school authorizers, right? Like they have basically every type of choice imaginable. And so I was sort of surprised when I got in and looked at the numbers. And yeah, I mean, they definitely have plenty of school choice there. But if you look at Mesa or, you know, Tucson, they're not necessarily like in the top, you know, 10 or 15 or 20 places. And so, you know, it's there's sort of the perception, and then there's the reality of how things actually work. Like you said, you know, obviously some of the big cities in the Northwest and the West Coast, San Francisco, you know, Portland, Seattle. I mean, I should mention the way we've defined this, right? We're not trying to quantify sort of intra-district or inter-district school choice nationally, because that would be impossible. But if you define it the way we've defined it, right, which is basically, you know, real alternatives to the districts, there are some big cities where there is still shockingly little choice, despite the fact that we all know it's grown.
Yeah. And look, some of these places are in states that do not have charter friendly policies, at least right now. I mean, California, for example, you've got Fresno, Long Beach, two big districts there where there's still very little school choice. And, you know, but the politics are tough in California. But look at Texas. I mean, Texas has a ton of places that, again, have lots of kids, lots of poor kids and kids of color, and relatively little school choice. El Paso is one of those places that comes to mind. Fort Worth, some of the inner ring suburbs around Houston and Dallas, like Fort Worth, but others where, again, these are not sprawling. Well, they're maybe sprawling in a Texas sense, but they are places where there's plenty of population density and kids in need. Other places like Tennessee has been going gangbusters, but Chattanooga still has a lot of room to grow. North Carolina has been growing fast, but again, there's still plenty of need in places like Winston-Salem and Fayetteville, which has a big military presence there. So, you know, you can go around the country and look. Two more places. Nevada, man, Vegas and Reno, huge upside potential. Again, Vegas, one of the biggest districts in the country, and very few kids participating in school choice. So there is room for growth. And for folks out there who are running charter school networks or, you know, funders who are interested in keeping the movement growing, we hope that this helps them look for some places that they should dig into.
Us too.
All right. My speech over. All right. So just for last words here, David, Luna, you've been digging into all these data. And again, these great interactive visuals that we've got here. What are some other interesting tidbits that people can play around with if they want to when they look at the website?
Well, I think the thing that is most interesting to me personally is the subgroups, right? I mean, we, at least for these big districts, right, we are actually able to show, for example, within the Asian community in Chicago, or pick your big district, right, where these kids are going and how that's changed over time. And I don't think it's been done in quite this way before. And I really just encourage people to look at the interactive visuals and click around, because a picture is worth 1,000 words.
Yeah. Luna?
Yeah, just adding on to that, the interactive figures are really the unique part of this report. So like David said, I just encourage people to go in, click through the districts, see where they stand in terms of competition. You know, there's plenty more places in addition to the ones that you named, Mike. Like Mobile, Alabama, for example, is a place that comes to mind where over 90% of the non-white students there, you'll see in the figures, are attending their district schools. So that's just another example of a charter-friendly state that can look and say, here's ample opportunity to add charter schools. It's just one of the examples of how you can use these figures.
All right. We will leave it there. Thank you so much, Jeanette Luna from Fordham, for joining us. David, for getting to be interviewed rather than the interviewer. That's all the time we've got for now. Luna, you know, understand your first time on any podcast. Hope you'll come back sometime soon.
I hope so. And, you know, I heard about Fordham because I started listening to the podcast. So I feel like I've made it in life now. I've been on the podcast as a guest.
I love it. All right. Well, you're going to have to set some new life goals now. All right, everyone. That's all the time we've got. Now it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute.
Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mike.
So are you and David as excited as I am about my Michigan Wolverines, number one in the nation, number one seed in the college football playoffs, a college football playoffs that is without controversy whatsoever this year?
Mike, I'm pretty sure you wake up every morning and are more excited about every topic.
Oh, that's nice.
About any topic.
That's nice of you to say. Well, that's just my radio voice, David. That's you know.
It's not just his radio voice.
I know. You know, people say that we Michigan fans are annoying, and it's true. Hey, I also did notice, because I do try to read a lot, that the Columbus Crew, which are fan favorites of our Columbus Fordham office.
Look at you.
In the championships this coming weekend, right?
That's right. I noticed that too.
Yeah. So that's exciting. Against who are they playing? Los Angeles? Is it something like that?
I have no idea.
Okay. All right. Well, go Crew, if that's what you say. But also go Blue. And the good news is, folks, listeners, we have many, many weeks until, you know, the big playoff games on January 1st. So I can talk about this again ad nauseum until then.
And you won't be surprised to know I was not at home on the couch watching college football. I was starting my Christmas shopping.
So, oh, good for you.
I'm wondering if your wives were out doing that while you both were on the couch.
Man, you're a glutton for punishment. Who goes to the mall at this time of year? That seems crazy. Oh, my gosh. All right, Amber, what you got for us?
All right. We have a new study every week, but this one's a descriptive study out from Calder, our good buddy Dan Goldhaber, and his co-author, Maya Goodman-Young, examining grade inflation before and after COVID in Washington State to see if the ease up on grading that took place during the pandemic has returned to pre-COVID norms or whether grading standards have been permanently lowered post.
You know, we're going to have to start calling this the grade inflation podcast because this is a favorite topic of ours. But hey, people, it is important.
It is very important. So we're all aware that many states and districts implemented no zeros or no failing grades during the pandemic. Washington State, just a little bit of background, how it went, you know, up and down in Washington. So in 2020, the state said, you know, you might consider adopting pass or no credit grading policies. In April, it went to high school students and middle school students taking high school credit bearing classes should be encouraged teachers to assign incompletes rather than the pass or no credit. And then in the fall of 2021, districts were told, you know, they were in person now or hybrid, and they were then allowed to assign failing grades. But districts responded with a range of policies, like, for instance, Seattle advised teachers to keep to an A to C minus scale. So anyway, the guidance from the state, you know, kind of fluctuated. Districts, what they chose to do towards the end fluctuated. We've got student level data from the state, including test scores and high school credit bearing grades for students from 2010-11 to 2021-22. The latter, again, middle schoolers who took Algebra 1 or Geometry. They look at both how the share of grades and average GPA shifted over time in various content areas. And for the kids who had both the test scores and the grades, they look at the relationship between the two over time, just using some regressions. So prior to the pandemic, the figures show a slight uptick in math and English grades before any, you know, big pandemic. But consistent with the state guidance, almost no students received an F in the spring of 2020. The share of Fs dropped from 10% to 1% in English, from 9% to 1% in math, from 9% to 1% in science between the fall and spring semesters of 2020. The distribution of grades higher than F mostly increased for A grades. So with the share of A's jumping from 33 to 56% in math, the share of A's jumped from 36 to 60% in English, and those A's jumped from 33 to almost 60% in science. The average GPA in math jumped from 2.6 to 3.2, in English 2.7 to 3.3, science 2.6 to 3.3. However, English and science grades largely returned to pre-pandemic levels by 21-22, but math grades have not. The math GPA in 21-22 was 2.7, so 0.4 points higher than it was in 2018-19. Then they account for the fact that the grade level in which a student took a subject might be correlated with achievement in that subject, so they want to control for grade levels. And we might have shifts over time in the likelihood that kids took a certain subject in a certain grade. And then they basically find that the predicted place in the test distribution based on their letter grade received, that drops for all math subjects between the first year of their observation, so 2015-2016, and the first year of testing after the pandemic, 21-22. For example, a student who got an A in Algebra 1 was predicted to be in the 73rd percentile of the test distribution in 2015-16, the 68th percentile in 2018-19, and the 58th percentile in 21-22. Now let's go to Algebra 2. A student receiving an A was predicted to be in the 64th percentile in 2015-16, the 58th percentile in 2018-19, and the 54th percentile in 21-22. So those were, you know, those percentiles were going down over time with the students getting an A, but the patterns were not true across the board. So a geometry, you know, that's obviously math. Those patterns have stabilized more. In English, the shifts in grading standards were not as big at all. They were fairly slight. And in science, they were smaller still. So they're going to be digging out around the future, trying to figure out, you know, what are the differences by subgroups. They've got a bunch more analysis planned for the future. But their big takeaway was, you know, we might want to be concerned about the misalignment between grades and student achievement in Algebra 1, especially because that's a gateway class. Since tends to tell parents, you know, your kid's prepared for more advanced math. So if that signal is off, you know, could be a problem.
Wow. Interesting. Well, the first thing I noticed about the study is that it took place in Washington, which is another school that is in the college football playoffs. So I just want to point that out. But they are ranked below Michigan. The second thing I should say is it's puzzling about math. I mean, I wonder why math teachers would partake in more grade inflation than the science teachers and the English teachers. I don't know. David, I mean, any guesses there?
Yeah, it's a little counterintuitive to me too, Mike, because in some ways it's like more objective, right? You might expect it to be stickier in the squishier ones, right? Like, I don't know, you wrote a good opinion piece in English and your opinion is valid. So how can you not get me an A-, right? But if you can't do fractions, you can't do fractions or whatever it is. So I agree that it's a little puzzling. And it's not really how I associate. I don't know. It's not consistent with my experience with math teachers either. At least my personal experience with math teachers is that they tend to be tough. But I don't know.
I wonder if it's just clearer that they didn't teach a skill. Right. Because we know that math is more skills based, you know, English sort of less so. Math is more linear, building upon prior skills. English is less that way. So maybe teachers are well aware that they didn't teach a particular skill and maybe want to take it a little easier on the kids because they feel more responsible. I don't know. Just throwing it out there.
Yeah, I don't know. Mike, I'm reminded there was a great Economist article a few years back where they plotted the number of razor blades on a standard razor and predicted that every razor would have 100 blades by like 2030. Yeah, because, I don't know, like Schick had just released the Cinco or whatever it was.
Right.
And I was doing the math in my head and something's got to give here, right? Because if we gain a percentage, whatever it was, one grade point per year, it was 0.4 grade points in 4 years, you know, we're going to have everybody gets an, it literally will be everyone gets an A in Algebra 2 by, I don't know, the mid 30s. So is the backlash coming? Or are we just going to add another?
Right. And maybe this will normalize. I mean, this is the big question. Some of this was still happening during Zoom school. I mean, I don't even know, like kids were taking math tests over Zoom, I guess, right? Maybe there was more cheating, you know? It's hard to figure it out. So maybe we just got to keep tracking it. And when, you know, we get the data for more sort of in the back to normal, back in schools, we'll see. I mean, what we do know is that kids lost a lot of ground in math, right? It turned out that school's really important for teaching math. It's a little less important for these other subjects that, frankly, have a lot to do with vocabulary that kids aren't going to just lose, you know, because they're not at school. But if you're not practicing math and learning new math skills, you are going to lose ground. And that is certainly what has happened here during the pandemic.
I really like the point about, you know, how grades play a somewhat different role in Algebra 1 than they do in other subjects too, right? Because I hadn't really thought about that before, right? But like, you know, we've argued about like, what is the grade for? And is it for effort? Is it for attendance? Is it for being on grade level? Is it for turning in your homework, right? And I think it's intuitive, at least to me, that those things could play a bigger role in other subjects, right? But in math, I do think it's important to master one thing before you do the thing, the next thing that requires you to know the first thing, right? And so I think in, as usual, we seem to somehow be getting the worst of all possible worlds.
And on that happy note, I think we should wrap it up. Okay. Oh my goodness. All right. Well, again,
he's going to have a happy note, you know?
Well, yes. And that's what we got to keep hoping for, right? We got to get kids back in school, back in class. We got to get teachers grading tough again. And of course, that is not to say that we need to get back to normal, not like the pre-pandemic normal was good, right? But there were some things we were doing right, like, I don't know, getting most kids to school most of the time or not giving every child an A. So let's at least start there. All right. Thank you, Amber. Very good stuff. And thank you, Dan and your colleague, for that great study. That is all the time we've got for this week. So until next week.
I'm David Griffith.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at fordhaminstitute.org.